This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. Not quite Tony Perkins today. Again, he's off doing something very important, I'm sure. I host the morning show for American Family Radio. Many of you hopefully tune in from 8 to 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I also represent the American Family Association as the Director of Governmental Affairs in Washington, D.C. All right, so that's who I am. And let me tell you, this is a very big week, not the least of which is the hearing for Judge Neil Gorsuch opening in the Judiciary Committee just today. This is how it sounded.
Let me begin by asking you,
Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is a big day for you and your family. You've been before this committee once before for the confirmation hearing to the 10th Circuit where you now sit.
Our job is to determine whether Judge Gorsuch is a reasonable mainstream conservative or is he not. Our job is to assess how this nominee's decisions will impact the American people.
The ABA's unanimous, well-qualified rating for Judge Gorsuch confirms that he has the highest level of professional qualifications, including integrity, competence, and temperament.
All things very positive for a Supreme Court nominee. And if all those things I've read were sufficient reason to confirm a nominee to the Supreme Court, of course, Chief Judge Merrick Garland, who had exactly the same qualifications, but was refused by the Republicans, would be sitting on the court today.
All right. You know, if you didn't know that this nomination is probably the most important thing that President Donald Trump will do in the next 4 years, you might go to sleep, because that was some of the oldest senators serving the longest period of time in the Senate. If you've ever been to a Judiciary Committee, it's pretty droll. But that was Chuck Grassley, Dianne Feinstein, Orrin Hatch, and then Patrick Leahy. Well, Carrie Severino, I'm sure, brought life to that room, and I'm sure she was watching the entire thing. Carrie is with the Judicial Action Network. She's the chief legal counsel and also policy director. And she really, people in Washington look to Carrie for her insights because they are keen. And I've asked her to join us today. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for joining
us. Hi, so good to be here, Sandy.
All right, so Carrie, that can be pretty droll, but what were the things about that hearing that really stood out to you?
Yeah, so I think a couple are, one that we saw, it previews a little bit from the Democrats of the kind of attacks that they're going to be making in the exchange with the judge in the next few days. So you saw them cherry-picking his record, and, you know, of course, every case a judge sits on, someone loses. But you go through the record, and you find some cases where very sympathetic-looking parties have lost a case, and then they've been trying to magnify that and to say, oh, he always rules against employees, or he always rules against women, et cetera. Simply not true. And I think his record, when he has the opportunity to refute that, will really show that. You've also seen them trying to talk about, well, he needs to meet some special burden to show his judicial independence because they're so frustrated with Trump. They still haven't forgiven him. You even had people bringing up the whole canard about, well, he didn't win the popular vote, apparently because they haven't read the constitutional system for electing a president. But, so they're still frustrated about the president being there. And we're going to see more of that. We're going to see more concern about, they think Garland should have had this seat. We heard a little bit of that in the clip she saw today. So all of those things are going to be rehashed. But you also heard, which I think was really significant, bipartisan support for him. And the people that introduced him, you had both Colorado senators, including Democratic Senator Bennett, who is not quite ready to endorse Gorsuch completely, but he did say this is someone who has clear record of judicial independence, clearly a fair-minded judge and committed to the rule of law, and that really kind of takes the wind out of the sails of some of the complaints of the Democrats, as well as someone who did clearly endorse him, Neil Katyal. He was President Obama's former acting solicitor general. He's actively in a case suing the Trump administration right now. He's representing Hawaii in one of those lawsuits against the Trump travel order. So this is someone who does not agree with the Trump administration by a long shot, and yet he says that Judge Gorsuch is someone who is incredibly well qualified, gives every lawyer before him a fair shake, does not let politics get in the way of it. And so I think that really speaks volumes. The people who know him best are the ones who support him. It's a little hard to hear for the Democratic senators who are so, enmeshed in the politics, but I hope they'll see through to recognize what a great justice he would be and ultimately will vote for him.
You know, Carrie, when I came to D.C., it was 2001, and I did sit on some of those hearings for justices, because that's when the American people, at least to my knowledge, really came alive and awake to the importance of Supreme Court nominations. Now, we saw what happened to Robert Bork. We saw what happened to Clarence Thomas. And I think we were on the slow learning curve, but the American people finally realized that this was an issue about which we needed to be educated. So along with that came tons of opposition. You know, I remember being in that committee room, and I remember all the opposition research, all of the money on advertisements to try to tank and destroy these candidates. You don't see anything like that for Neil Gorsuch, do we?
Well, they haven't actually spent as much money opposing him, which I think is a good sign. I think partly it's because the Democrats have had trouble figuring out what their best line of attack is. It's hard to attack someone who is as widely respected as Neil Gorsuch. He's gotten unanimously well-qualified recommendations from the ADA twice now. He has a decade on the bench, over a decade on the bench in the 10th Circuit, is very well-respected there. You know, sitting on a court where the majority of the active judges are Democrat appointees, he has a 98 to 99% unanimity rating in the cases he has sat on. So that really says something. So, you know, they've been trying out things like, well, we'll say he's out of the mainstream. Chuck Schumer was saying the nominee was out of the mainstream before we knew who the nominee was. And it doesn't really hold a lot of water with someone like Neil Gorsuch. They've been saying they should be concerned about his judicial independence because we're worried that he's going to just approve everything Trump does. Well, Neil Gorsuch has a better record than almost anyone I could think of really being explicit about saying, I don't think you should give a lot of deference to the executive. It's funny because Judge Garland, Obama's nominee, really was known for being very deferential to the executive branch and sometimes letting them almost rewrite the laws themselves. Gorsuch is the opposite. So Democrats really should be cheering that, oh, good, we've got someone who's going to be skeptical of, you know, maybe what Betsy DeVos is doing in the Department of Education or what Scott Pruitt's doing in the EPA. It isn't just going to take their word for it and what the law means. But no, instead, they're kind of playing partisan politics as normal, and they're trying to build the case for gridlock. That's what the left base is really asking for. Let's have a filibuster. Let's stop this guy no matter what. And I just think it's going to be really hard for them to lay the groundwork for that gridlock because he's such an excellent candidate.
Carrie, the hearing started this morning, but of course the senators have to have their day in the sunshine. It's always pretty annoying, but anyway, it's part of the process. So they go on and on and on. They talk and talk and talk. But finally, at 3 o'clock, Neil Gorsuch spoke for the first time. What did you think?
I thought he exactly as we would have expected from hearing. You know, we heard from him very briefly in January, but you can tell he's someone who's very thoughtful. He told some delightful and kind of heartwarming stories about his family, about his relationships with some of the judges in his life who were really models. And he talked very eloquently about the importance. He used the analogy of the black robe and how this is something we wear these robes in order to remind ourselves that it's not about us. It's about treating everyone equally in front of the law, that we're fulfilling a role here for the government. This isn't something that we're doing ourselves as a Republican, as a Democrat. It's really part of this process of equal justice before the law. And I think that's something his commitment to is going to be a real treasure for this country.
Carrie, you have an article that just came out in Real Clear Politics, the Democrats' intellectually weak attacks on Gorsuch. And I'll let people find that and read it because it's excellent. But I want to ask you about this. I'm being devil's advocate, so please allow me. You write this. You say, Democrats also complain that Judge Gorsuch's textualist approach to the law, by which he interprets laws according to their plain meaning as written, makes him a judicial radical. In fact, Judge Gorsuch clearly swims in the mainstream of American jurisprudence. According to one study, 98% of the opinions he wrote for the 10th Circuit have been unanimous, even though that court tilts to the left. 7 out of 12 of its active judges were appointed by Democrats. Okay, make the case for why that's good. Then I want to know if is it good or bad. I'm kind of wondering, is that a good sign or a bad one?
Well, I think it shows that he is approaching the law in a way that doesn't mean, as the Democrats will say, he votes with the Republicans every time. No one should be voting based on, I agree with you because we come from the same philosophical background, or we vote for the same party, root for the same team. It should be someone who looks at the law. And in many times, we always hear about the most controversial cases, but really, many times, he pointed this out in this hearing, you wouldn't know it, but Justice Sotomayor and Justice Thomas are in agreement 60% of the time. They're on the opposite ends of the spectrum, but the most of the time they do agree, and it's even higher numbers if you look at Justice Breyer and Justice Scalia, also both on opposite ends of the spectrum. So one of his points is that we focus often on these ideological divides in the court, and really some of the most important issues, it's true, do break along those 5-4 ideological lines many times. But if a judge is doing his or her job, they should be able to look at it and look past that. I think that's something that he has done in many, many cases on his court. So he's not afraid to dissent when he has to, and he's done that in many cases. He has one case, I think it's funny, he even concurred in his own opinion. So he wrote the opinion, and then he wrote a separate opinion that wasn't joined by the other justices, just to say, you know, here's a concern I have with the direction this law is going and why I think the Supreme Court should go a different direction with it. But that shows that he understands, how to express his opinions when they do differ from his colleagues. But he also knows how to build a coalition when you can get on the same page about the legal result.
Okay, just a few minutes left here, Carrie. And I, of course, the important question before all of us is what things are pending. Some things we know, like the immigration orders of President Donald Trump, which are legal legislatively and legal by mandate of the Constitution, and yet a rogue judge in Hawaii has ruled that this second immigration order must be halted. So that's going to be a big one. But how could we know? We're not supposed to know how he votes on this, right?
No, on all of them. However, you can look at his approach and hopefully get some ideas. So, for example, one of the important cases coming up before the court this April that I think he ought to be on the court in time to sit on is the Missouri Lutheran case that challenges Missouri's Blaine Amendment. These are amendments, they're 19th century kind of artifacts of the current anti-Catholicism at the time. They were trying to make sure that no state money went to Catholic schools, and they just said you couldn't have any funding. Missouri's is really extreme, saying directly or indirectly benefiting a religious group. Well, that would go so far as to say you can't call 911 from your church and get an answer, or they can't sweep the sidewalks or the streets in front of the churches. That can't be right. And in Missouri, they said they won't resurface a playground. It was the same funding they give to every other school, and it can't do it if it's a Lutheran school. And even though the fact that kids are playing on the playground has nothing to do with inculcating religion, you're not playing Bibles, you're not paying for hymnals, et cetera. So that case is coming up. Knowing that there's someone like Gorsuch who recognizes the importance of religious freedom, we've seen that in his decisions in Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters, and really just who's willing to look at the law neutrally. I think if you look at the Constitution or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act neutrally, you should be able to recognize that the Constitution protects religious freedom. And I think it's when you look at it and with a political approach and start saying, oh, no, but they're talking about contraception on the other side, or, oh, no, but religious freedom is just code for, I hate this group or that group. That's when you start getting these decisions having problems. Gorsuch doesn't appear to have that lens of hostility to religious freedom, and I think that's all you need. It's just someone who's willing to view it with an open mind.
Carrie, 20 seconds. Do you think he will pull this off? Will he be nominated?
Absolutely. As Leader McConnell has been very clear, this guy's going to be confirmed. He'll be confirmed before the court goes on recess for Easter. So I think April 7th is that day, so that'll be exciting to have a new Supreme Court justice.
Wow, and a wow. All right, Carrie, you wouldn't say that if you didn't believe it. So I trust
Absolutely.
Your judgment. So thank you for bringing that good news. Carrie Severino, Chief Counsel and Policy Director for the Judicial Crisis Network. This is Sandy Rios for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
From Samaritan's Purse and Franklin Graham comes Facing Darkness. In 2014, as the Ebola virus was devastating West Africa,
the numbers of new cases and deaths are still rising.
International relief organization Samaritan's Purse stepped up.
God has called us to care for the dying, to care for those that are suffering.
We can't say we're Samaritan's Purse and not help.
My phone rang. One of our doctors, Kent Brantley, has Ebola.
And then David looked at me and he said, "You too have Ebola."
We're there to save life. We're there in your name. Why?
Despite the fact that things were out of control, we knew that God was in control.
God puts you in places and supplies the strength to deal with.
Jesus Christ didn't run. We run to the fire. We don't run away from it.
Facing Darkness, a true story of faith. In select cinemas for one night only, Thursday, March 30th. For theaters and tickets, go to facingdarknessmovie.com. That's facingdarknessmovie.com.
I'm a widow. I've worked for a bank for 31 years, and I've been retired now for 10 years.
Myrtle Norris comments on her experience with the AFA Foundation.
I had a lot of financial questions, and Dan Celia was, he answered my questions, and he helped me with a lot of decisions that I made. And then the charitable gift came up, and he explained that to me. I decided to get it, and I'm sure glad I did, because I know now that money is in a place that I know God wants it to be, and also get my monthly income from it. I believe in the AFA and what they're doing, because they're working for us.
Learn how the AFA Foundation can work for you. You can contact the AFA Foundation through Facebook, on our website, afafoundation.net, or call us at 800-326-4543, extension 345. Thank you for supporting the American Family Association.
I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets. Try very hard not to engage in any isms of any kind, including McCarthyism.
Well, I'd laugh, but I don't think it's very funny. This is Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. It's really sad to me when you see the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who was once such a trusted figure, testifying before Congress and finding yourself wondering if he's really telling the truth. I'm filling in for Tony today, this is an issue that really eats at me. I guess because I have to say, my morning show listeners know that my husband was with the FBI for a number of years, just retired a few years ago. So this is a subject close to my heart. So it really is disturbing. There are many FBI agents who don't trust Director Comey right now, retired and otherwise, and maybe for good reason, because he's making light and he's also misrepresenting. And while he said in this hearing today before the committee, the House Intelligence Committee, he's there to discuss two things: whether the Russians actually were involved in hacking the election and helping Donald Trump win and defeat Hillary Clinton, and whether the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians in order to win the election. And so I have to say, according to, if you listened to me last week when I was hosting Washington Watch, we had Larry Johnson on, who's a former CIA, not the director, but certainly a supervisor who was there for many years and also with the State Department, who had very different information. And when Director Comey says that the Justice Department has no evidence and the FBI has no evidence, that really does not, it's not a sufficient, that's all he knows. But I have to say that insiders are saying that it did not go through justice, that it went outside of the normal path of things. I think Judge Andrew Napolitano mentioned this after I talked about it with Larry Johnson last week, saying that from three different sources, they were told that insiders were saying that the president of the United States then, Barack Obama, went outside normal channels and actually went through British intelligence. And because British intelligence can name the names, they can surveil American citizens, whereas American agencies are allegedly prohibited from doing that, that the information came from British intelligence. So Director Comey and the Democratic congressman had quite a back and forth, alleging, of course, that Donald Trump, alleging that Donald Trump's campaign colluded with the Russia, alleging it. Comey refusing to say that there was no connection, even though we know that James Clapper, the director of the former CIA director, and also John Brennan, CIA, and Clapper, Defense Intelligence, and others have said repeatedly that there was no collusion. And yet, for some reason, the FBI director wants to leave the impression that there was collusion. So I have a little problem with that, especially when we know that he refused to pursue investigations of the Clintons when we knew for a fact that there was, I knew because I did lots of shows on this about the interactions between the Clinton Foundation, taking money from the government of Haiti for giving contracts to friends, just unbelievable things, selling our uranium deposits that ended up in the hands of the Russians, and on I could go. And so not so much to see there, according to Director Comey, but on the Russian connection with the Trump campaign, while we must keep investigating, even though the agency heads are saying there's no collusion. Yes, I have an opinion on this because I think this is really dangerous. It should be very frightening to us to think that director of our Federal Bureau of Investigation, the once highly respected organization that we all look to, I think may be at this point in time not trustworthy. You know, Devin Nunes, who's the Republican head of this committee, asked this question. This is clip 9, Brent. Let's listen.
So my question as of today, Admiral Rogers, do you have any evidence that Russia cyber actors changed vote tallies in the state of Michigan?
No, I do not. But I would highlight we're a foreign intelligence organization, not a domestic intelligence organization. So it would be fair to say we are probably not the best organization to provide a more complete answer.
How about the state of Pennsylvania?
No, sir.
The state of Wisconsin?
No, sir.
State of Florida?
No, sir.
The state of North Carolina?
No, sir.
The state of Ohio?
No, sir.
So you have no intelligence that suggests or evidence that suggests any votes were changed?
I have nothing generated by the National Security Agency, sir.
Director Comey, do you have any evidence at the FBI that any votes were changed in the states that I mentioned to Admiral Rogers?
No.
Thank you.
All right, so but the dance goes on, inferring that there's something untoward. And, of course, President Trump got involved tweeting. He's pretty upset about what he's hearing in this hearing. I think a lot of people are. I heard Catherine Herridge report earlier this afternoon just pointing out the facts that even though the director says they're still investigating connections between the Russians and the Trump campaign, that all the directors and heads of the national security organizations in this country, the intelligence heads, have said there's no evidence. In fact, the assistant to the FBI director was in the White House, 3 weeks ago, according to Reince Priebus, met with him and didn't come to meet with him, was there for another meeting, pulled Priebus aside, who's the chief of staff for Donald Trump, and told him there was no evidence, absolutely nothing. We found nothing. And yet they continue, so says Director Comey. Didn't so much continue in the investigation with Mrs. Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, or Mrs. Clinton and her email, the loss of the national security secrets that may have come from her carelessness handling her home server, also just the breach of national trust, the breaking of agency rules and laws. Nothing about that. That's not a big deal. Director Comey, you know, not so much that. There's nothing really much to see there, according to him. Just that she was careless, he said. But about Donald Trump, here we are, I don't know how many months passed, and yet they must continue to investigate, you see. It's a pretty amazing thing. And, of course, the thing that the Republican congressmen in that hearing are trying to get at is who leaked the name The American, who was on the other end, Michael Flynn, of the Russian ambassador, because that's illegal. It's a felony. You can be convicted for doing that. Who did that? That's not so important. But the continuing investigation by the FBI into Trump, that's the important part. This is Sandy Rios on Washington Watch for Tony Perkins. Right back after this. We'll be right back.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, probably one of the most important numbers coming out this week is going to be durable good orders. We'll take a look at that. It's not coming out till Friday. It's expected to be lower than it was last time out. So the February numbers expected to be somewhere around 1.3%. I suspect it's going to be higher than that. Last look we got was 1.8%. I wouldn't be surprised to see 2% this look, but they're expecting 1.3. I think they're going to be wrong based on some other numbers. We also are getting some important housing numbers coming out. Existing home sales will be out on Wednesday, and then on Thursday we get new home sales. So that's a number everybody is going to be watching. These are both February numbers. Remember, this is February, but we have had a fairly warm February in some parts of the country, so maybe that'll help as well. But it looks like those numbers could be a little bit better than what was expected. Eurozone growth, it seems to be rising a bit, but it's still what they would consider very sluggish, and they're looking at wage growth, though, just slightly up. One of my biggest concerns as we look forward is going to be Deutsche Bank in Germany, as they reported a huge loss and are cutting bonuses to 80% of the people and slashing some other areas. We'll watch that closely.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
Well, this is just, it's a farce now. The idea that we have in this town, the media, the agencies, the Congress are running around chasing their tails on a story that everyone knows is not true, but having to pretend that it might be because he's the president when we know how it's going to end. And the one thing about the HGHQ, we've got a lot of real enemies in the world. Do we really have to go around antagonizing our best allies?
That was Charles Krauthammer on a special report, I think, from Friday night. Sandy Rios back with you, filling in for Tony Perkins today on Washington Watch. You know, I love Charles and have great respect for him. He's a smart guy. But on this issue, uninformed as far as I'm concerned, I totally disagree with him. I don't think it's a farce. I think it's very dangerous. You know, Larry Johnson's word to us last week on air was his best information. Again, he's the former CIA agent operative, was there for years, and also with State Department, that he's hearing from agents inside that. And of course, I can't verify this, but this is where I'm sure Andrew Napolitano got his information. He says three different sources. I only have one, so Larry Johnson's probably one of them. And they are saying that that the president sidetracked the normal procedures to do this. And why would that be such a surprise? I mean, they have leaked. They were monitoring General Flynn, and he was in Trump Tower working on the campaign. So it's they're surveilling, wiretapping, whatever they're doing with Michael Flynn, and we know the content. They have a transcript of the phone call. Does anyone seriously think it might not be possible that they would do the same with Donald Trump? I mean, look at the conversations he had with world leaders that were leaked. Was the Mexican president, I can't remember what other president, but they monitored him. And they actually leaked the content of the conversations. Who was doing that? Of course, that was after he was elected. But we also know, people on the inside know, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that there are operatives from the Obama administration still very much in place, especially national security. And so it's a farce. It's really so far-fetched to think that Barack Obama, who now, by the way, is doing everything he can to undermine this president, and maybe I can make that case. Maybe we'll do that on tomorrow's show because I'll be hosting for Tony again tomorrow. There is concrete evidence of him doing that. In fact, he allegedly had a conversation with that Hawaiian judge just at dinner right before the Hawaiian judge issued the stay on the second immigration order. And that immigration order in Hawaii was brought, the argument, the case was brought by the imam of the largest mosque in Hawaii with connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, I'm just saying, what's going on with that? That judge, of course, went to law school with Barack Obama. So those are loosely strung details. Might not mean anything, just like it might not mean anything that Loretta Lynch met with Bill Clinton on the tarmac of an airplane or an airport around the time of the Clinton scandal. So there are lots of things here. It's beginning to seem like almost anything's possible, and I believe that it is. Now, Trey Gowdy asked Comey a really pointed question because he believes, as I do too, that the whole business of whoever leaked Michael Flynn's name had transcript of the phone calls to media, to the Washington Post and others. This is dangerous and it is illegal, and that's what we must find out. This is Trey Gowdy in the hearing today.
How would you begin your investigation, assuming for the sake of argument that a U.S. citizen's name appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times unlawfully? Where would you begin that investigation?
Well, I'm not going to talk about any particular investigation.
That's why I said in theory.
You would start by figuring out, so who are the suspects? Who touched the information that you've concluded ended up unlawfully in the newspaper? And start with that universe and then use investigative tools and techniques to see if you can eliminate people or include people as more serious suspects.
Do you know whether Director Clapper knew the name of the U.S. citizen that appeared in the New York Times and Washington Post?
I can't say in this forum because, again, I don't want to confirm that there was classified information in the newspaper.
Would he have access to an unmasked name?
In some circumstances, sure. He was the Director of National Intelligence, but I'm not talking about the particular.
Would Director Brennan have access to an unmasked U.S. citizen's name?
In some circumstances, yes.
Would National Security Advisor Susan Rice have access to an unmasked U.S. citizen's name?
I think in general, and any other National Security Advisor would, I think, as a matter of their ordinary course of their business.
Would former White House Advisor Ben Rhodes have access to an unmasked U.S. citizen's name?
I don't know the answer to that.
Would former Attorney General Loretta Lynch have access to an unmasked U.S. citizen's name?
In general, yes, as would any Attorney General.
So that would also include acting AG Sally Yates?
Same answer.
All right, so here's the thing. Michael Flynn, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who was with the Trump team until he was let go because he was dishonest about having a conversation with the Russian ambassador on the telephone, and it embarrassed Vice President Pence, and so Donald Trump asked him to resign. It isn't because he colluded with the Russians, which is what they keep claiming. And I also would add that in regard to Director Comey, his deputy director, Andrew McCabe, you know, remember that his wife was running for Senate during the campaign, got $500,000 from Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, who's very close to the Clintons. And it's just, and then he was the one who oversaw the Clinton email scandal. This is his wife, meanwhile, is running on behalf of a Clinton operative fundraiser, getting $500,000 from them, which he failed to claim on his forms at the FBI. There's a lot of rottenness here. And I'm just saying, I just don't take it at face value what the FBI director says right now. I'm really sorry about that. My phone's being wiretapped, I'm sure. That's okay. That's okay. All right, Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. And coming back will be Stephen Moore because we're going to talk about the Trump budget, which came out just this week, and it's pretty amazing. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios on Washington Watch.
Whoa, we have not had a response like this before. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We've been doing these spiritual heritage tours for like 20 years. We're sold out for June already, if you can believe that. We've got space left on our September tours of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and then Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. We call them spiritual heritage tours, and I don't know how long these September seats will last. To what do you attribute that to, someone might ask? Maybe it's the fact that we have a new person occupying the White House. Maybe that has something to do with it. But in any event, we welcome you to come with us on our September Spiritual Heritage Tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon and Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. Those are two separate trips. You can do both, or you can do one or the other. We'd love to have you. Go to spiritualheritagetours.com. spiritualheritagetours.com.
Join Norman Geisler, Richard Land, Michael Brown, Frank Turek, and others for Southern Evangelical Seminary's National Conference on Christian Apologetics. It's October 13th and 14th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Enjoy informative talks, a live debate, and a dialogue with Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis. Plus, there's the premiere of the American Family Association documentary, The God Who Speaks. Register by May 1st and receive a special gift. Visit ses.edu for details.
Physicians keep learning after medical school in order to better save lives. Shouldn't Christian leaders keep learning to better save souls? Hi, I'm Dr. John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi, and online around the world. Are you a Christian leader who thinks it's important to keep learning? WBS online weekend and evening classes allow graduate students to become better equipped to make disciples in a constantly changing world. For more information, visit wbs.edu.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. America's not Israel, and Israel's enemies weren't and aren't exactly the same as ours. Consider the following in Deuteronomy 20. God told the Israelites to totally destroy the Canaanites as the Israelites wandered the wilderness, because the Canaanites teach abominable practices, thereby leading to sin against God. The church doesn't kill sinners by the sword, but we must kill our sin by the word. God is zealous for his undivided honor and for the purity of his people. At the least, that would include opposing pornography, the LGBT agenda, and would it not also include resisting the infiltration into our country of Islamic supremacists whose God is Allah and whose intention is, in their own words, to kill the infidel? May God help our governmental leaders have understanding to know what to do, and may God help them. This is a Decency Minute. Find us at AmericanDecency.org. I'm Bill Johnson.
Well, and again, we'll get to long-term entitlement reform discussions, along with tax reform discussions, revenue flows, larger policy decisions in the fuller budget that we will roll out in May. This budget yesterday was just the spending budget, what we call the blueprint, the budget blueprint. It's the first step in the traditional appropriations process that will now go to Congress. But certainly, we will be looking at all of those things as we try to figure out how to solve the problem you just mentioned, which is that we have tremendous risk. We have exposed ourselves to risk as a nation by having this $20 trillion debt. If interest rates go to their 40-year historical norms, we could spend more than $1 trillion a year on interest payments, which is just debilitating. So that's one of the things that was in the back of our mind as we formulated this budget. We wanted to rebuild the military. We wanted to guard the borders. We wanted more money for things like Veterans Affairs and school choice, but we didn't want to add to that deficit. And that's why we reduced spending in other places, because the president is keenly aware of the risks that that level of debt brings to the nation. What is the overall message of this budget? We need more money for this president's priorities. We need more money to enforce the border. We need more money for school choice. We need more money for law enforcement, enforcing all of the laws on the books. Those are the priorities of this administration, but also not adding to the deficit is another priority. So that's what we did in our budget. If the House and the Senate do it a different way, that's fine. We'd be happy to negotiate with them as we go through the process, but the top line message doesn't change. Rebuild the nation. Don't add to the deficit.
All right, that was former Congressman Mick Mulvaney, who is now the director of the Office of Management and Budget for the Trump administration. And honestly, it's a pretty stunning initial budget that President Donald Trump has released, and it's getting kind of lost in the shuffle here, and I don't want it to. And by the way, it raises discretionary defense spending by $54 billion and cuts domestic discretionary spending by the equivalent amount. No one can explain this better than my next guest. Stephen Moore is a distinguished visiting fellow for the Project for Economic Growth at Heritage, formerly with the Wall Street Journal. And I know Stephen because he's formerly from Chicago. And so with that, Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, what a great way to start. Sort of like, can you believe what's happened to our state as a result of the ridiculous policies of the left? They're destroying it economically.
Well, that's true. And, you know, there's this attitude in Washington that all this money that Washington spends at the federal level are somehow free money to states and free money to citizens. And, of course, that's not true, because the government can only get money in the federal budget. if it takes money from the states in the first place and from the workers and the families and the businesses in the states. So there's this kind of a mirage somehow that it's such a wonderful thing when the federal government shows, quote, compassion by spending money on these trillions of dollars of programs that could be much better spent either by the, you know, on the private sector through those private initiatives or through state initiatives or local initiatives, government closer to the people. But this idea that somehow federal government is omnipotent and omniscient and knows what is needed around the country is just false. And of course, when you got a government, as you just said, that is borrowing $1 trillion a year and has $20 trillion of debt, the federal government doesn't have any money left over to give to states.
You know, and I guess I see the reason I mentioned Illinois, and I could mention California too, is because in Illinois, you know, they're not, they can't even pay lottery winners right now.
Exactly.
And pensions are in terrible trouble. Their like a credit rating is probably, I think it's lower than California's right now. Illinois is tanking. People are flooding. Businesses are leaving. And my point is, this is kind of exhibit A of what's going to happen federally if we don't get a hold of our spending.
Well, I've been saying the same thing, so I think great minds think alike. I mean, you look at the two states right now that are in the most financial difficulty, it's Illinois and Connecticut. And both those states have major tax increases on, quote, the rich, because that was going to solve all their budget problems. And of course, as you just said, Illinois, I'm from Illinois, by the way, as you mentioned. I grew up in Illinois. I have a great affinity for the state, the land of Lincoln, but it's being ruined by the teachers' unions and the politicians who run Springfield, by the way, the teachers unions really run that state, and they just want more and more and more money, regardless of whether the money is being spent wisely. So Connecticut, by the way, is the same thing. Connecticut keeps raising the taxes. They've raised taxes 4 or 5 times in the last 8 years, thinking that's going to solve their budget problems, and they're sinking like a rock into the ground because they can't, and people keep leaving the state. They go to Florida, they go to Tennessee, they go to Texas, anywhere to get away from the enormously high taxes in the Yankee state. So we have two good examples right there in Illinois and Connecticut of states that have sort of destroyed their economic base by trying to balance their budget by raising taxes on families and businesses.
And I think just to drive the point one more time, you know, I think when we go about our business as citizens of a state or a country, and we think, you know, oh, well, those politicians, and we think that it's not going to have an effect. It may take time, but it eventually has a terrible effect, and it will create poverty and unemployment and destitution, and that's what we're trying to stop. So, okay, Steve, you worked on the Trump transition team. You were one of the first people out of the box to take a stand on that. What was it about Donald Trump that made you so early on support him?
You know, I think it's that he was, I went to a number of his rallies and saw him in person and met him in person. And look at this man, like anyone has flaws, no question about it. But I saw a way that he connected with middle-class, working-class Americans and could, you know, could really relate to them. It's funny because there's a billionaire who, you know, you think of as someone who wouldn't have a connection with middle-class people, but what he was saying resonated so much with the people around there and around the country, whether it was in Michigan or whether it was in Wisconsin or whether it was in Illinois or Pennsylvania or Tennessee or Oregon, everywhere that he went, he seemed to be capturing the hearts and minds of the American people. And I just saw that there was something special about his ability to connect with the American people, very much like the way Ronald Reagan had 30 years earlier. So I did support Donald Trump, and I'm happy I did. I think he might have been the only Republican who could have defeated Hillary Clinton. And now he's got to get the job done. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, that he's got to do something about this enormous budget. I mean, it is a disgrace that we as a, you know, we're supposed to be the world's economic superpower. We're borrowing $1 trillion a year. We can't pay our bills. We've got hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars of waste in Washington. We've spent $500 billion over the last 25, 30 years on the Department of Education. There's no evidence that it has had any impact on raising test scores. In fact, test scores are lower today than when we started spending all that money. So I could go through hundreds of examples of wasteful spending, but I think the American people know it. The only people who don't know it are the politicians in Washington.
Yes, and that's why this budget is pretty, you know, I know it's a first start. I recognize, you know, in fact, Citizens for Limited Government, I think it's, we're saying this is a great start. Now Congress should double the cuts, which is actually a good point. But to start with, President Trump is suggesting a 31% cut in the EPA, a 28%, this makes me laugh, given what's going on with the national security chaos. State Department, 28%. Department of Education cuts, NPR, PBS. It's pretty amazing. Stephen, did you have a part in writing this?
You know, the Heritage Foundation, the place I call home, really, you know, I wasn't the principal person, but we all worked on this budget, you know, a kind of blueprint budget. And it's amazing how many of our recommendations Donald Trump took. So that's very gratifying that budget writers in the Trump administration followed the advice of the Heritage Foundation. It was a good budget. It's a gutsy budget. It basically says we can't keep playing Santa Claus for everyone. And, you know, I've been on a number of interviews. I was on CNN this weekend where I'm a contributor, and, you know, the host were saying, well, gee, you know, this lacks compassion. And I said, look, the federal government doesn't have compassion. It takes money from us forcefully, and it gives to another person. Now, when you and I act charitably or with compassion, that is compassion. But the government doesn't have compassion. and so, you know, look, if these programs were so wonderful, like NPR and these community development block grants and these after school programs, why can't the local communities, the people living there, why can't the states fund this? Why is there the first impulse is to have the United States taxpayers pay for all of this?
Well, it doesn't make sense. And of course, we probably should say again, what you're very familiar with, and I'm sort of familiar with, is states have to meet their budgets and the federal government does not. And there's nothing there's nothing kind about spending people's money who are working so hard, Steve. So many people are working so hard in this country and they're paying taxes, paying them faithfully, filing their income tax. And you take that money and you just give it away to silly programs, unnecessary programs, duplications. That's not compassionate.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, this will infuriate people. It should infuriate every American. But there was a report that came out a few months ago by the federal government's own auditors, their own auditors, that said every year the federal government wastes more than $150 billion. Now, that's $150 billion, not $150 million, $150 billion on erroneous payments and food stamps and Medicaid and Social Security that, you know, goes to dead people and Medicare and so on, people who are not eligible or are getting these benefits. You know, can you imagine a private company allowing that kind of fraud to happen? It happens every day in America, in Washington, and nobody does anything about it. And thank God Donald Trump is saying that's going to come to an end. And he's right.
All right, this one thing that I am curious about, I kind of get it, but I don't quite. And that is this whole notion that I do understand that wealth is not finite. You know, I think that's one thing that people think, there's a certain pot of money and some people have a bigger part of that pot and others have less. But the idea of economic growth is that you grow that pot so that there's more money, more wealth. It isn't that somebody gets what belongs to somebody else. But Stephen, on top of that, if you start spending money on infrastructure, which Donald Trump is proposing, and start spending more money in the military and cutting, the entitlement programs, how does that add up? I mean, the idea is that it grows, you bring in more revenue, and eventually you'll cut down on that debt. But is that kind
of? Well, the top priority, I agree with Donald Trump entirely on this, and he said it, you know, in private and public to me, which is that, you know, you got to grow the economy first. You got to get people in good-paying jobs, and you got to get the businesses profitable again and expanding. And when you have that bigger tax base, it's a great way to raise tax revenues to basically have more people working. And every time you put somebody to work, think about this: now they're paying taxes; they're not, you know, on welfare and other programs. So this is something that we learned from John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan and other presidents, that the best welfare program is a job, right? And so we got to do that. And once we get people working, we can reduce this deficit, and then we can start making some of the cuts in these programs that are necessary. And Donald Trump proposed major cutbacks, as you just mentioned, in a lot of these programs. And of course, the people in Washington went into cardiac arrest when they heard about this, because, you know, many people in Washington will lose their jobs. But my goodness, you know, three of the five wealthiest counties in America are in Washington, D.C. We're getting rich at the expense of the rest of the country. And that's why when Donald Trump said at the end of his campaign, his closing argument is, I'm going to drain the swamp. Guess what? That's exactly what he's doing.
You know, Steve, I don't think people really, I've said this on the air, but I will repeat it since you brought it up. Being in Washington as long as I have been, it's just amazing how much money people make. And most of the time, couples are both working. So it's not uncommon for two people to be making in excess of $200,000 working for government, or $300,000 or a whole lot more if they have higher positions. But baseline jobs are getting six figures. I mean, I don't know what baseline to me may not mean what it means to you, but just not extraordinary jobs, not extraordinary positions are making six figures. And so this is a drain. All those hardworking people listening to us across the states who get up every morning or make an hourly wage or, you know, work is to me honorable no matter what you do. If you work hard, to me, that is honorable. But they are working hard for maybe $100 a day or I don't know, but they're not making these kinds of money, but it's coming out of their pockets. It's just wrong.
It's so wrong, and you're right. You know, when you consider a lot of these federal employees are making $110,000, $120,000 a year, that's like three times what the average family makes, you know. So, you know, two or three times what the average family makes. And by the way, those families, as you just said, they are coming out of their smaller salary or taxes to pay for these people who have, salaries two or three times higher. So it's not fair. Liberals love to talk about fairness. How is that fair to tax the little guy and give it to rich people in Washington, D.C., yes, which is what the federal government really does? And I'm for returning, and we started this conversation by you asking me about returning power to the states, and I think that's so important, returning power to the states and the people. That's what the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the Bill of Rights say, that all rights not specifically reserved for the federal government belong to the people in the states.
Stephen, what's going to happen with this budget? Because you know we have a big spending Congress. We have a big spending Republican leadership, from my perspective. So are they going to pass this budget, you think?
It's going to be very difficult. Congress likes to play Santa Claus. They like to hand out special interest favors, and they love to pass out the candies and nuts to the people, and they don't have any fiscal discipline. And there's some, you know, very good people in Congress, but they're outnumbered. So this is why, you know, I do what I do. It's why I'm talking to you. We've got to get the people stirred up and demand that these cuts be made, that we restore fiscal discipline. You know, the liberals love to talk about how much they care about the children, all of these programs, benefit all the children. And I always laugh when I hear them. I say, well, who do you think is going to pay for this debt? I mean, it's not going to be me and you. It's going to be our children and grandchildren. How is all this deficit spending helping our children? It's a joke.
It is a joke. It is a joke. All right, Stephen, thank you so much. It's great to talk to you, Stephen Moore. And we're going to make it not a joke. We're going to turn this thing around, God willing. Distinguished Visiting Fellow for Heritage, thanks for joining me, Steve. It's great to talk to you again. But thanks for all your hard work.
Night.
All right, you too. Well, this is C80 Rios again. I've been filling in for Tony Perkins tonight on Washington Watch. I'll be with you tomorrow as well. And we'll see what the night brings. I know there'll be a lot of things about FBI Director Comey that we'll be talking about again. And, of course, the hearings for Neil Gorsuch start tomorrow morning at 9:30. And, by the way, Tony, of course, is the president of Family Research Council. If you'd like more information, it's frc.org or at T. Perkins is his Twitter handle, at T. Perkins. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, it's at Sandy Rios Tweet, at Sandy Rios Tweet. By the way, I'll be at First Baptist Church Dallas a week from Sunday night and would love to see you there. All right, so thanks to FRC for allowing me to host and to Tony in particular. Have a great evening, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Sandy Rios.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.